If anybody wants to.
And Jay, sorry, Guy, turning it over to you.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Guy Brandenburg. I'm the current president of NCA. And I wanted to make a few announcements and welcome. This is our March 2023 meeting, if you didn't somehow know that. And our speaker is Alex Dittman. He's got some interesting stuff to show us in just a few minutes. And if you haven't joined our email, all you have to do is send an email to that URL, Capital Astronomers plus subscribe at groups.io. Or you could just use the chat button on your Zoom screen and send me or the or Todd or whoever. I guess I'm in charge of the listserv. And if you need to reach me, there's a bunch of things you can. I do not do Twitter. Okay, so let's see. Next slide. How do I get the next slide? Okay, fine. All right. We've got a very nice hydrogen alpha telescope. I've had a great time just in my neighborhood taking it out to sort of a market area in the Brooklyn area of DC, and put up these two beautiful posters on a sort of an A-frame thing, that hold these really nice informative things. And it's nice to have this because it's, you could say, you see that squiggle that you saw there? Well, that's one of these, that's a filament. That's, and then you could explain what that is. And this thing weighs maybe 15 pounds, and this weighs, there's a box, and this tripod thing can go with it, if you like. But I think any clear day, we should have this in use. And the images are really good. The images also change minute by minute as the air around us changes. So sometimes you just see a ball, an orange ball. But you know that the color here is completely wrong. The guy who made this photo said, yeah, artistic license. People got annoyed if they saw a red sun. Maybe they didn't think it was the sun. But sometimes you see lots of detail. And then a minute later, it's turned to fuzz, and it's not in your eyes. It's just the air doing funny things. So volunteers, you know, you can let me know. You can let Jay or know. You can just talk in the chat. And if you read the latest Stardust, we almost got busted. No, that's not true. We didn't. It was nowhere close. But somebody thought that this was a dangerous object on McKinley Street near Connecticut Avenue in Northwest Washington. So they actually called the cops on us. And yes, they actually saw some of the text exchanges. They just showed me the Android screen. I couldn't believe it. So this telescope was made back in 1971 by a then young woman by the name of Mary Jane Boswell. And it's too big for her now. And so I turned it into a really, I think a really, really nice Dobsonian, shortened the tube, painted it green. Oh, you can't really tell, but it's got a nice front thing made by Alain Sole, 3D printed. And yeah, it works great. And you can rotate the tube to any position, and the movement is very good, and the optics are very good, and put in a better focuser. So it could be yours for a price. With I'm thinking about $400.
Hey, Guy. Guy. Oh, yes. What are the specs on that telescope? I did not see them in the Stardust. Maybe there were there. Maybe they were there, and I just missed them. So
no,
you probably maybe a 6-inch.
No, it's an 8-inch f/6.
Ah,
I'm sorry for not putting that in. I wish I had. Yeah, and the optics are very, very nice. Really is great. And it's recently re-illuminized by us. Okay, so Earth Hour. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's actually been going on since quite some time now. I forget what year it was started by somebody like Audubon, might have been. But in any case, it's Saturday, March 25th, and it's for 1 hour. And what you try to do is get your company, your landlord, your neighbors, and your own family to turn their outside lights out and then go outside and do something useful, positive, like talk to your neighbor. We're actually not having a very easy time of getting local governments and officials to comply. I got one local company to say, yeah, we'll do it, but we won't be the first. We want somebody else to be first.
Probably Capital Weather Gang. Maybe they'll put something in the post on it.
Oh, that's an idea. Anybody else have any other ideas? That's a great idea. Yeah, and that, well, if you have any other ideas, I'd really like to know what sort of ideas people have for doing this. I'm not the one who came up with the idea. I am a member of the International Dark Sky Association, DC chapter, and NCA is a member of that organization. And any of you, all of you are interested in astronomy, and you should all be interested in joining NCA. Sorry, not NCA, but the International Dark Sky Association, because it's so ironic and sad that now that we can actually understand what all those lights are out there, you know, way beyond us, our knowledge has gone so far in the past 100 years. It was only 1920 that it was sort of decided that, yeah, those other fuzzy things, they are other galaxies. So that's only 103 years. Think about how far we've come in that time. But now nobody can see the stars, partly. And we're killing off the insects, and we need insects for food. And, you know, when you think about all the money that had to be spent on places like Blue Plains and this big dig they're having for, you know, treating water pollution and air pollution, what a big stink that caused metaphorically, how much money it cost to clean the air. It's so much cleaner now than when I was a teenager living here in DC. It is amazing how much progress we've made. And fixing the lights doesn't even cost that much. We know how to do it. But please tell your neighbor, tell your company, any government agencies, more people to call up and spread the idea, the better. Two more announcements. We're going to restart meeting in person. Of course, it's going to be hybrid. So those of you who are, it's more convenient to continue to do it electronically via Zoom. We'll have two options. Attendance did go down quite substantially when we went to all virtual monthly meetings. Exploring the Sky starts up April 15th, and Hugh J. Miller's email. Jay, can you tell us a few things?
Well, Stardust does list the schedule for the year. This year, it's different. First of all, this is the 75th anniversary. So we've been doing it at this spot for 75 years. As far as I know, it's the oldest continuous astronomical program in the National Park System, since we do it with the people at the Nature Center, which is part of the National Park System. This year, what the park is doing, the Nature Center is doing, an hour before the meeting, they will have a planetarium program. And at the end of the program, people will walk over to the spot where we have the telescopes, and we'll do the observing. If the sky is cloudy, rainy, etc., they will still have the planetarium program. So in a sense, exploring the sky will still go on no matter what. We just won't be able to go outside if it's rainy or cloudy. But exploring the sky will still go on. So that is something new.
Thank you, Jay. I don't know how many of you have followed the column by Blaine Friedlander in Washington Post every month. At the beginning of the month, he had a column called Skywatch, and apparently he'd been doing it for 36 years. He must have started when he was about 25, because he has given it up, which is a shame. And it is clear from subsequent articles that the Post is not going to find another replacement, and which is too bad for us, because they actually did give us and events at the National Air and Space Museum and the Northern Virginia Astronomy Club and any other clubs that they heard about. Blaine would advertise those, and I'm sure that, you know, certain non-negligible fraction of people,
yeah, they did,
our events came from reading about Skywatch. So we will not have that venue anymore. Supposedly weather gang, Capital Weather Gang, is going to have.
I will be telling them about exploring the sky, and hopefully they'll put that in there. Okay. Because that the Skywatch column helped to pull people into exploring the sky.
Absolutely. So have you talked to or emailed yet with anybody at the Capital Weather Gang yet?
Not yet.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, good luck on that. And I will do the same. And other people can do the same too. You know, that's how the NRA is so powerful, just the fact that they're only a small, group, is their people call up their congressmen and their senators and their mayors and everything else. They bug them and they bug them and they bug them. And they're very, very successful, considering their small numbers. But in any case, on April 2, I just heard about this like a day or two ago. There's going to be a public viewing event outside the National Air and Space Museum on the south side of Independence Avenue. It's, I forgot to write this. It's the
Eisenhower Memorial.
Right.
They do that a couple of times a month.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah. No, this is something different.
Oh, okay.
This is something different. Okay. So I would double check about the location, because we got contacted. It's not the Air and Space Museum observing event. This is specifically the National Mall organization.
Something. You're right.
And
So
double check where it's going to be near the Eisenhower Memorial. It's not associated with the Air and Space Museum. They may be participating.
Yeah.
But it's not them organizing it. It's National Mall organization something.
Yeah, I remember reading about that now.
Yes. So we're going to have some grad students and undergrads participating in that event somehow. It'll be kind of, we're going to be organizing our little piece after everyone gets back from spring break.
Okay.
I participated in that last year. There was a really good turnout for it. Lots of members of the public wandered by and looked through the various telescopes that were there. A number of astronomy clubs had scopes out. Now, I was with some folks from the Goddard Astronomy Club. There were people from NOVAC there. They're, I think maybe Greenbelt also. So it's quite a good site made for a spot that's right downtown.
Yeah.
It's fairly open, and there are, of course, street lights around, and they were there not as bothersome as I would have expected. That the weather was not very cooperative that night, as I recall. No, you could see a couple planets early on, but not much else. So, too many clouds. So,
okay, thank you. Thanks for the clarification, Elizabeth, because I really did not double check the letter before writing this. I was in kind of a hurry. Whoever this group is, one of the list of people who are interested in coming. So please let me know so we can put down NCA as an organization, and they want to kind of know what kind of equipment. I don't know where we're going to park our vehicles, but we'll see. That's the announcements I think I have. One more. I only know two people who have NCA t-shirts. That would be Jeff and Jay. Maybe some other people do. No NCA swag of any sort. Like our speaker was showing you, joining us from Los Alamos. And it's easy these days to have it made. We got plenty of cash in the bank. We've got over 10 grand. And it certainly helps to identify the organization that's helping with outreach and reach and public events. And here are a few ideas, hats of all different types, t-shirts, mugs, pens, magnetic bumper stickers. And we have two logos. One was made, I understand, by Bob McCracken back some years ago. And there was some discussion this serve about the heart design that showed up in the middle, which I had not noticed. And that's on the right hand side. In the middle side, we have a more recent one done by Mike Larkin, who's also been helping with the NCA website, some great amateur telescope maker and astronomer. And anybody want to come have some ideas?
Hey, Guy.
Off of your heads? Yes?
Guy, we don't need to invest any money into buying anything. There are websites now set up so that once you input your logo and you select which items you're going to let people sort of apply the logo to, then all the money kind of gets handled so that people can buy what they want so that we don't have to deal with any kind of inventory.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay, because buying mugs and buying t-shirts and how many of what do we order? No. Yeah. You just say figure out which source, which on-demand printer you want to use. You set it up and you here's the logo and you can apply it to these items.
Oh, that sounds great.
And then that way only what is wanted gets bought.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. So if you can give me one of those websites, that'd be really wonderful, because I did not come across that when I was doing the research. Thank you.
Yeah, we can talk offline, and I'm sure that someone else may actually be able to give me or provide better information. I just recently kind of started doing some stuff along these similar lines.
Cool. Anybody else have ideas?
Fun fact, the The logo that we're using on Stardust is actually a scan of my t-shirt. A number of years ago, I don't remember why we needed a new copy of the logo for Stardust. Unfortunately, Bob McCracken's original had gotten lost, and as far as I know, it still is lost. We had been discussing getting new t-shirts or getting the t-shirts remade, so I had taken mine to the NCA board meeting thing. I think it was Gary Joaquin, who was star editor at the time, scanned my t-shirt so he could use the logo on Stardust. So
about when was that? Because
a long time ago.
Yeah, so I remember that exchange, and the reason we needed a new logo is because we needed a banner
two
different things.
Yeah.
No, I think it was all
around. I think it was even before the banner.
Oh, no. That I don't know. Okay. Any other comments or ideas? Okay, softly. All right, so let's go. Go, go. Next slide. All right. So
hi, Todd.
Hello. Announcements. I have an announcement if we're ready.
Yes.
I forgot to put in the newsletter that the upcoming APS Mid-Atlantic Senior Physicist Group meeting is on Thursday, not Wednesday. It's on March 16th. It's Tachyons, Messengers from the Future is the title by Robert Ehrlich. Just want to make sure people know.
Thank you. Well, I have no more announcements. Does anybody else have any announcements? Okay. All right, John.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Alex Dittman, our speaker this evening. Alex is working toward a PhD in astronomy at the University of Maryland. And his advisor is Cole Miller, an outstanding researcher and teacher in the astronomy department. Alex grew up nearby to here in Falls Church, Virginia. He received undergraduate degrees in both physics and astronomy from the University of Illinois in 2018, and both degrees were awarded with highest distinction. While an undergraduate, he also won the Stanley Wyatt Memorial Award. One of the persistent important puzzles in astronomy and astrophysics is the state of matter at various depths within neutron stars, which next to black holes are the most extreme compact objects in the universe. The Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, NICER, is its acronym, is a NASA telescope on the International Space Station, and it measures X-ray emissions between 200 to 12,000 electron volts and is the most sensitive instrument for doing so. Alex is a member of the science team for the NICER instrument, and in 2022, he was co-recipient of the Bruno Rossi Prize as part of the NICER team. In addition to his research on extreme compact objects, namely neutron stars and black holes, including the outstanding question of the equation of state of dense matter, Alex also does research on the accretion disks of matter that orbits these extreme objects. Some of those extreme objects are members of binary systems, either a pair of extreme objects or an extreme object co-orbiting with an ordinary object. And of course, that affects the accretion disk. He also develops mathematical tools that are useful throughout science and engineering, such as new algorithms for solving differential equations. In addition to their research, graduate students are often asked to help teach courses. Alex was recently awarded an Outstanding Graduate Assistant Award. This award was established to recognize outstanding contributions by graduate students to students, faculty, departments, and the university as a whole. Receiving this award recognizes Alex as being among the top 2% of campus graduate assistants this year. This evening, Alex will tell us about unexpected phenomena that occurs in matter that is orbiting a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy that has a central bulge like ours. Alex.
Right. Well, thank you very much for just a wonderful introduction. I have to say, unfortunately, I'll mostly be talking about galaxies a little unlike ours. Mostly supermassive, so active galactic nuclei, although we think the Milky Way had an active phase, just like sort of the ones we see in other galaxies a few mega years ago. But yeah, thank you for the lovely introduction and also just the invitation to speak here. I'm really excited to talk about this research with all of you. So yeah, I'll talk about stars orbiting supermassive black holes that are actively accreting. And this started with a project with Cole Miller, and also it has been carried out in collaboration with some scientists at the Center for Computational Astrophysics in New York, especially Matteo Cantiello. So just to look at where we're going over the next hour or so, I'm going to start off with a very brief introduction to active galactic nuclei, and then I will talk a little bit about how stars can end up inside the disks of gas around these supermassive black holes. And after that, I'll talk about how those stars' lives differ from the lives of normal stars in the interstellar medium. I'll talk about phenomena such as even full stars and bugs. We'll see what that means later. But to start off, I'd like to start with an active galactic nucleus, or maybe a spiral nebula, if you will. This is one of my favorites visually, just a lovely Hubble image of M51. And in addition to these beautiful spiral arms and all of this gas and stars, down in the center here, we see this little bright spot. And somewhere in the innermost few parsecs, somewhere in there is a supermassive black hole that is actively accreting matter from some disk. And it's pretty darn bright. And then in a sort of cosmological sense, this is actually one of the more dim ones. We see others that are many, many billions or millions of light years away and billions of times as luminous as the sun. And they're so far away, when these were first discovered, people thought they were stars until they measured spectral lines from them and saw they were just incredibly redshifted by factors of a few, and realizing these were at cosmological distances from us and therefore had to be just really, really extremely bright. Actually, let me know if any of the Zoom overlays are in the way. I can try to fix that if necessary. But anyway, to get an object, something that is billions of times as luminous as the sun, that's actually quite a challenge, because most galaxies only have, say, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 12, give or take, solar masses of material. And nuclear fusion isn't actually that efficient at converting rest mass into energy. So it would take more than a galaxy's worth of material all actively undergoing nuclear fusion to just make that much light. So the mechanism that now is commonly thought to power all of these is actually just matter falling into the very deep potential well of a supermassive black hole. And that can have ballpark 10% efficiency even at converting this rest mass into energy, maybe more if the black hole is really rapidly spinning. So we think that these really bright objects are powered by the accretion of gas onto supermassive black holes. And here's just a lovely image of M87, another local-ish AGN. And then zooming in on the center there, I think everyone has already seen the EHT pictures. So this is one of the simulations that was used to inform that EHT image. And this is showing sort of the black hole and little gray surface. And then the color is showing which gas is actually really emitting light to go and form that image we see. Now, even in these nearby objects, unfortunately, so with a few very rare exceptions, we can't really actually see what is going on with the gas nearby. And even then, we can only really see near the horizon in the EHT case. We can't see very far away from it. So although we can't directly see actually images of these disks of gas, we can look at spectral lines. So one thing that people have been able to do since roughly the 90s is using X-ray spectroscopy, look at the sort of inner really bright regions of these active galaxies and measure iron emission lines. So this gas is so hot that you have essentially iron atoms with the sort of electron orbital structure of hydrogen and helium. They're just that ionized. And if electrons get kicked out of these innermost orbitals and drop down, you have this fluorescent line at about 6.4 kilo electron volts. And if the gas were static, then that would just be a really sharp feature at that energy. But this gas is moving so fast, we can see just from the width of this line here, that tells us actually that the gas is moving at about a third the speed of light. So just incredibly extreme. But then it isn't just a wide line. The line is also highly blue shifted, or actually red shifted in this case, a little bit of blue shift, but very asymmetric. And this is telling us actually that this has a disk geometry. If it were, say, a spherical inflow or something along those lines, then the emission line would be much more symmetric. And here the dotted line is actually tracing out sort of a prediction from a disk model to this, you know, then cutting edge data. And even then, so in the mid 90s, there was strong evidence for this gas actually having a disk shape near the horizon of these black holes. And then now telescopes have improved a lot since the 90s, and people can actually very pretty reliably measure things like black hole spins from the subtle changes in these emission line profiles based on the space-time. And this figure on the bottom is showing a comparison between two different codes that people use to predict the shapes of these lines. But even with that, there are some questions about how these disks of gas actually form, and then how large these disks are. So we have direct evidence that this matter forms a disk very close to the horizon, but it isn't clear how far away. Parsecs, tens of parsecs, fractions of a parsec. There's still a lot of debate of if that happens and how often, what conditions lead to that, and actually how AGN are just fed in general. So one idea is that after a galaxy merger, you will have just a lot of gas sloshing around in the inner regions of galaxies, and that this could then lead to AGN phases. So this is the sort of thing that people can see in some cosmological simulations, and also there is some observational evidence sort of correlating AGN activity with other post-merger signatures. On the other hand, some people think that you can just have, say, stochastic turbulence in the interstellar medium leading to clumps of gas having relatively little angular momentum and being able to fall into the, or fall very close to the supermassive black hole. And these are a couple of examples from a simulation that was, the paper came out a little bit just towards the end of last year, and it actually resolved from a few parsecs down to fractions of a parsec. So really something like 6 orders of magnitude and distance trying to follow the path that gas takes as it falls towards these supermassive black holes. And just for slightly different gas turbulence, you go from these very large, many parsecs in size disks of gas forming to this very sort of chaotic accretion flow, where the big boxes here are about 2 kiloparsecs on each side, and the small sort of zoom-ins are about 200 parsecs. So just depending on the turbulence, you can get either these huge accretion disks, or in the other case, it doesn't look like disk to me very much, although they say a small disk does form right near the black hole itself. Another way to feed black holes is through stars. So we observe many galaxies have nuclear star clusters, and so even the Milky Way has a nuclear star cluster of its own. And we think that a lot of the gas that is currently accreting onto the on Sagittarius star could be from stellar winds. So it isn't very much compared to some of the quasars out there, but there is still some accretion probably from these stellar winds. If you had a lot of stars, that would then give you even more accretion. Additionally, so it's actually very difficult for supermassive black holes to tidally disrupt stars. just because their Schwarzschild radii are so large, you end up swallowing stars whole before tidally disrupting them. But that's another story. But if you have very sort of later in their evolution stars, like red giants, those can still be tidally disrupted by supermassive black holes. And one possibility people have considered is that if you have some of these red giant stars coming very close to the supermassive black hole, although they don't get completely ripped apart from the tidal forces, some part of their outer envelopes can get stripped. And this could lead sort of periodically to flares of the AGN as it goes and accretes these stellar envelopes. So that's another possibility that people are looking into. I'd like to cover some observations of AGN that could be related to stellar populations in and around these disks. One is that some people have found just giant flares in AGN light curves. So when people just watch active nuclei, they flicker on timescales from hours to years. And this is just some data from the Catalina real-time transient survey. And we can see just the scatter from the individual points up and down on those very short timescales, but then superimposed over that regular AGN variability are these massive flares, sometimes a few magnitudes over hundreds to thousands of days. And these are even brighter than, say, superluminous supernovae in some cases. But so no one is really sure what these are. We'll have a few ideas that include stars getting tidally disrupted in these AGN systems, and also supernovae going off in or very near the disks of AGN. And the idea there is that, as you probably are familiar, so much of the energy in supernova is actually just in the kinetic energy of the ejecta. And we only actually see sort of a small fraction of that energy that is actually released as light. But if you have a dense medium surrounding these explosions, that might help you convert some of that sort of bulk motion of the ejecta into heat and then light we can see. Just another puzzle of AGN is that they appear to be really, really rich in metals. So these are some data points that were collected from a large number of AGN spectra. So using the widths of various emission lines to try and measure the metallicity of the gas. And here they found that binning it in different redshifts, so this isn't a product of how these systems evolve over cosmic time, there is not only a pretty strong correlation between the metallicity of these AGN and the sort of host mass of those galaxies, not only is that metallicity supersolar by a factor of a few, right? So this is log Z over the sun's metallicity, but these are also enriched in metals compared to sort of typical galaxies of the same mass. So these orange and blue lines are tracing out sort of approximate curves for the metallicity of galaxies as a function of that galaxy mass. So these galaxies, or so the AGN are systematically enriched in metals, or their AGN disks are, compared to their host galaxies. So something is enriching the metal content of these disks. Also, I showed earlier those examples, or that example, of a spectrum of an iron emission line. And when people are trying to model this X-ray data, one of the key ingredients in the iron line is how much iron there is. So, right, there's two ways to get a lot of iron. You either have very metal-rich gas or a lot of gas. So unfortunately, those are sort of tied together when people are trying to fit models to these spectra. But some people have inferred that there could be, say, enhanced iron content in the gas very near these supermassive black holes by factors of a few to even 10. Although, of course, that's a little dependent on actually the density of the gas as well. Then another puzzle that this is actually what got me into thinking about stars and AGN disks coexisting is just the existence of these really, really massive supermassive black holes very early in the universe. So people have found now multiple black holes that are more than a billion times the mass of the sun found in within the first billion years of the universe. So this is actually it's pretty challenging to make black holes that massive because there's a natural limit to how fast you can feed material onto black holes. And that is because as these black holes accrete matter, they shine, right? That's how we see them, why we think there are black holes there. But these photons carry their own momentum. So when you have enough light shining on something, that gas will feel on a pretty significant force just for all the radiation pressure. And eventually that radiation pressure can overcome the black hole's own gravity. And when you're in that scenario, it's really hard to feed more material onto the black hole. So it turns out that if you feed a black hole at sort of the rate given by that limit, the sort of e-folding time scale for the black hole's mass is 5 × 10⁷ years per take. So if you start off with a 1,000 solar mass black hole, there just isn't enough time in the universe to grow black holes to that mass. So there are a couple ways around this. Either you can find a way to start off with a 1,000,000 solar mass black hole, then it doesn't need to accrete that much gas. You can find some way to cheat the limit to just feed the black hole really, really quickly. That will also be able to make a black hole that early. And the other way is just to have a lot of mergers. So if I make, say, 1,000,000 10 solar mass black holes and they all merge together, then that can make these really, really massive black holes early in the universe. And something that Cole and I showed was that you have an accretion disk around one of these supermassive black holes. And it just, if the accretion disk forms stars, those stars can go on to die and leave behind black holes that can then merge. And it's just the accretion disk is a natural way to get mergers that help you make black holes this massive. All right, so with that, I'm going to move on to a little more star and AGN disks coexisting stuff. But if anyone has questions now, I'd love to stop for a little bit and cover those before getting on too far.
Actually, a couple of requests for clarification. When you go back to that slide that had was about active galactic nucleon, how they're fed, it was sort of a boost slide. Are those simulations or are those exactly data?
These are simulations, yes. Very
go
good.
Forward one.
These are also simulations.
Yeah, this the scale on the bottom, I'm not very good at Julian dates. How long are these?
So the scale, it's in days relative to whichever Julian day this was.
Okay. That's the number of days.
Yeah, so this is in days from I don't know which date that was. Although actually we recently passed 60,000, so I guess you could do the math. But yeah.
Good up. Okay. So those are over 10 years. 15 years. Huh.
Yeah, so this is quite disturbing.
Every 2 years or so. Okay. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Alex?
Yes.
Do we have an AGN in the Milky Way galaxy?
I guess it depends on what you mean by active. So the Milky Way, so Sag A star, Sagittarius A star in the Milky Way, does have flares every once in a while. We have really great observations of them. But on average, it is accreting very slowly. And it isn't really what we call active. It's relatively quiet, quiescent. There is some evidence that I'll talk a little bit about later, that it had a real sort of bona fide active phase about, say, 6-8 mega years ago. If I'm not mistaken, I think people use the size of the Fermi bubbles to try and measure that, among other things.
Well, then do we have a GN without the A?
We do have a galactic nucleus. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome. Yeah, and if people have clarifying questions or even obfuscating ones, I'm happy to take those during the talk itself. Okay, so if that's it, I'll move along just to talk a little bit about how we end up with stars inside these accretion disks. In general, well, they can either be born there or they can be born elsewhere and get trapped there. And here's just a little cartoon of that happening. Well, we have some of these stars formed inside the disk initially, and also some compact objects color-coded for your convenience. But then other stars, if they're in a nuclear star cluster around the disk, they can get trapped into the disk sort of by a variety of mechanisms from gas drag, dynamical friction, and exciting waves. And we'll talk a little bit about that imminently. So first, on just stars forming inside these disks, because the first consideration is that if we have a disk, that means that the sort of gas pressure isn't that significant, that the disk is relatively thin, so the azimuthal velocity of the gas is much, much greater than, say, the sound speed. If we had a faster sound speed, that would mean a higher pressure gas, hotter, and then it would be puffier and it wouldn't be in a disk. So the sort of relevant velocities to think about, or the relevant timescales, are like the orbital timescale of, say, a parcel of gas around the supermassive black hole. And as far as gravitational collapse, what matters is the free fall timescale of the gas. So if you have just gas, some cloud of gas of some density, it will collapse under its own weight on some timescale related to its density, more or less. So then if the free fall timescale is shorter than the orbital period of the gas, that means that self-gravity can start collapsing this disk into either, say, turbulent filaments or, say, stars or planets, depending on the mass of the clump. Whether or not you end up with, say, waves or clumps and objects forming in this disk also depends on how quickly the gas can cool. So this was studied really for the first time by Charles Gamy in 2001, just showing that if you have very slow cooling compared to, say, the orbital time of gas, then you just get this sort of quasi-steady gravitational instability-driven turbulence. And on the other hand, if the gas is able to efficiently cool, then the gas is able to form into these much higher density objects. And so depending on the mass of these clumps, they could be stars or maybe, say, brown dwarfs. We think that some sort of very far out exoplanets might have formed this way. Then on the right is actually just a paper from last month that was studying this. Instead of, so early work had painted on sort of a phenomenological, the gas will cool this fast because I said so in their simulations. And that was cutting edge at the time and gave us a lot of insight. And then just last month, some people came out and performed 3D simulations using actual radiation hydrodynamics. So actually following photon transport and doing sort of a really physically meaningful treatment cooling instead of just sort of prescribing something. And they were simulating AGN-like disks and indeed found that these clumps form and can form stars. Then just an application of this that people have thought about is actually this really peculiar set of stars in the galactic center. So within the nearest half parsec from our supermassive black hole, there was a set of 13 or so stars. And of those 13, 10 of them had kinematics. So not only physically are they sort of in a disk shape, but their velocities are also all more or less in the same plane. So this was made possible by some really precise 3D velocity information that people measured back in 2000. And then, it was found that these stars more or less also orbit in a disk geometry. And so one of the explanations for this is that these stars could have formed during the Milky Way's last really active accretion episode, when we think there was an accretion disk around Sagittarius star. And also the ages of the stars sort of match up with when we think the last active phase was. And then people have also looked at this in simulations. So the pictures I showed earlier were from sort of local simulations of just a patch of a disk, which is nice because you can use really high resolution and you don't have to worry as much about some numerical problems. But people have also looked at this in sort of global hydrodynamic disk simulation to see if, will show that you can qualitatively reproduce these sort of stellar kinematics. And then just a little bit on the other mechanism. So stars can experience drag forces as they pass through the disk. These drag forces depend pretty strongly on how dense the disk is. So if you have a star passing through a very low density region of the disk, then its orbit isn't affected very much, and the star may not even really be affected at all. But if the star passes through higher density regions of the disk, it can actually experience a pretty strong drag force, and its orbit can lose a lot of energy and also angular momentum. And this cartoon is also just illustrating if you have a star on an eccentric orbit, when it passes through the disk, actually, so initially, the lever arm, so this is on both an eccentric and an inclined orbit. So the lever arm for changing its angular momentum is pretty small. So mostly this eccentric orbit will get circularized first. And then after the orbit becomes circular, its inclination will start changing and it will become more aligned with the disk itself. And then once the star is actually within the disk, the star can excite waves in the disk, and those will further act to circularize and sort of bring it into the midplane. Okay, so that was a bit of a shorter section than the previous one, but I guess, does anyone have any new questions on that?
Not really a question, but I was always wondering how it happened that we get all these disks and not just sort of balls, and you're sort of explaining how that formation of accretion disks. Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. So I will say the other thing, part of it I think comes down to gravity sort of being in a way sort of a central force. I think orbits are naturally like disks or ellipses. So if you have some cloud of gas passing by a black hole, it will be on some sort of elliptical hyperbolic trajectory. So then if you have any sort of net angular momentum from some cloud of gas even, right? We see this in star formation, that even though it starts almost spherical, after it collapses, you're left over. Just there was some net angular momentum, and in the end, after it cools, you're left with a disk. Okay. So now that hopefully I've convinced you that stars and disks can end up in the same place at the same time. Actually wanted to touch on some earlier works that mostly focused on stars around AGN. So this goes back to actually the late 80s. And so around this time, people had been studying the degree to which these nuclear star clusters, well, stars in them, could lose mass and feed these supermassive black holes. And along the way, people wanted to study, well, okay, so we know these AGN are really, really bright. That should actually affect the evolution of these stars. So this group simulated that and looked at the effects of irradiation on the structure of these stars. So these are a few tracks comparing, so the dotted lines are just regular stars without any extra radiation. And then the black lines are sort of stars of the same mass, but this time with this incident flux from an AGN. And in general, the stellar radii, so this is looking at the stellar radii versus time. So the radii of the stars tend to increase, and much more so for lower mass stars. And I think qualitatively, you can think about this as just a little extra energy being added to the star, and that, you know, increasing the radii a little bit. But it also ends up depending on the details of opacity and convection and how much of the energy makes it to the core, things like that. But since then, people have also looked at this problem a lot in the context of X-ray binaries. So if you have a pulsar accreting gas from some companion star, then that companion star will be affected by the radiation from, you know, the accretion process onto that pulsar or just neutron star. And actually, this problem has in recent years come up in the context of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because it turns out if an alien civilization built a Dyson sphere around a star, it would reflect some of the light back and affect stellar structure in a similar way. So maybe if we're able to find very peculiar stars, that could be evidence of a Dyson sphere or something. I think Jason Wright at Penn State has been looking at that. And I guess actually, so one other, this paper also made another comment. I think now, so that was, this was back in the day, but if the universe ends up happening to be closed in the end, then we'd again have very irradiated stars. But henceforth, I'll be talking for the rest of the talk about actually stars actually being inside a disk. So not just thinking about the irradiation, but also how these dense disks of gas affect the evolution of the stars. And the first consideration, and the most important really, is just this dense gas accreting onto the stars and really appreciably changing the masses of these stars. So a rough length scale for this is sort of the Bondi radius. And this is just where sort of take the escape velocity from the stellar surface and compare that to the sound speed in the gas. And this tells us roughly where gas will be bound to the star. And then if we take that radius and then the density of the gas and then how fast the gas is moving, we can calculate the accretion rate just through the surface of a sphere with that radius. And that gives us an accretion rate onto the star that ends up depending on this Bondi radius squared. So the mass of the star squared times some density and the sound speed. So just right away, this tells us that if we have, say, a very low density disk or a very low mass star, then the accretion rate will be really, really small and this will be affected at all by the disk. Or it will, but it won't really matter. On the other hand, if we have a more massive star or a really, really dense disk, then this accretion rate could, in principle, be gigantic. And these stars could become very, very massive from this very large accretion rate that only gets larger as the stars get bigger and bigger. Then as the stars get more massive, they also get much more luminous. So for, say, gas pressure dominated stars, the luminosity of the star goes something like the mass of the star to the third. So eventually these stars too can reach that limit that I mentioned earlier, where the stellar radiation starts overcoming the star's gravity. And unfortunately, this is a really complicated three-dimensional process that we cannot actually include in our simulations of stellar evolution. So we need to make some assumptions. So we think that the accretion rate should slow down as this radiation pressure becomes really, really significant. And so to that effect, we've implemented just this formula that will decrease the accretion rate based on how luminous the star is. And also as the star reaches this extreme luminosity, it will start tearing itself apart from just radiation pressure and driving extreme winds. And so to account for that, we've implemented this mass loss prescription. Now, these are just some assumptions we made. They're definitely not how reality actually works, but we hope they're close enough. And later I'll show some tests that at least our qualitative conclusions don't really depend on these. Now, I won't show really, really low density cases where the accretion rate is small and the stars basically go about their normal lives. So I'll jump to a case where the accretion rate is large enough that stars are actually really affected in a meaningful way. And we call these intermediate stars. So this is just for a fiducial sound speed and gas density, how the evolution of a one solar mass star with a solar-ish composition changes over time. And so this plot here is just showing the mass of the star over time, jumping a little bit ahead in medias res. It's grown a little bit from the one solar mass origins. It has a convective core that is shown with this blue hatching. The color is showing what the helium mass fraction of the gas is. So this core is a little bit enriched in helium. It's been burning some hydrogen to helium. As the star grows, this convective core expands and starts mixing in some of this hydrogen-rich material that had accreted onto the surface. And it gets pretty darn massive, you know, 50 solar masses or so. And then at this point, it's so luminous that mass loss begins dominating accretion, and it staves off for accretion and goes down. It ends up burning through all of its hydrogen, all of its helium, and eventually even burning heavier elements than that, and going on to be some sort of compact object at the end of its life. It reaches about 10, 12 solar masses. And these bottom panels, we can just see the net material accreted and lost over time, as well as the core composition of the star. So we can see the helium and hydrogen mass fractions changing over time, this little blip where the core gets extra hydrogen that had been accreted onto the surface. Then eventually it runs out of hydrogen and then runs out of helium and will go be some sort of compact object. Now, this depends on the balance between accretion and mass loss. So if we increase the density, we can increase the accretion rate onto these stars. And if we do that enough, we get immortal stars. And in this case, the stars can grow to be really extremely massive and reach a sort of quasi-steady state where mass loss is able to balance accretion in a time-averaged way. So actually, if you look carefully, there are these little wiggles. The star isn't actually just at an absolutely constant mass over time, but it balances itself out on average. So if it gains a little extra mass, then luminosity increases sharply. It loses that mass, then that luminosity decreases, it's able to increase a little more. So on average, it stays about the same. And if we look at the core composition, in fact, the core, you know, once it reaches this immortal stage, it's very high mass, and the helium and hydrogen content in the core stays constant over time. And yeah, so these stars are burning just in the CNO cycle, burning hydrogen to helium. This core, actually, the star is almost fully convective. So material, as it accretes on, is able to really efficiently mix into the core to undergo fusion. And I mean, in principle, as long as these stars keep getting fed, they could just keep going. Of course, that isn't actually realistic. Something is going to need to stop this. These active phases don't last forever. No accretion disk lasts forever. Eventually, the disk will spread, it will accrete onto the supermassive black hole, and there will not be this just huge supply of gas ready to feed the star. Additionally, just over the star's lifetime, it could move to different regions of the disk where the disk conditions might be different and it might not be able to eat fast enough. However, if you do have enough of these stars, right, so this star is constantly taking in a bunch of hydrogen and then losing a bunch of at least helium-enriched material as winds. So if you have enough of them, it could actually sort of convert an appreciable fraction of the disk's hydrogen content into helium. Now, just to show a little bit of the physics behind this, we can look at a couple of timescales. So these are the two stars I showed on the past couple slides, where the masses over time are showed on the top panel, the core composition in the middle panel, and then the bottom is showing a bunch of time scales. And the important ones are the red dotted line, which is the nuclear burning time scale. So this is basically saying just how much fuel the star has divided by how fast it's burning that fuel, so it's luminosity. And then the other is the time scale for the mass to increase. So just the mass of the star divided by the accretion rate onto the star, which is this orange dashed line. So in both of these cases, initially the nuclear burning time scale is really long compared to the accretion time scale. That's why the mass of the star changes before the star just dies. But then in this intermediate case, eventually as the star increases in mass, it gets more and more luminous, and eventually it starts burning through its fuel faster than it gains more fuel. And then eventually, it goes and burns through all of its fuel and ends its life in some sort of explosive transient event. In the immortal case, this nuclear burning time scale gets shorter and shorter, but it doesn't get short enough. And actually, the accretion timescale stays shorter than the nuclear burning timescale. And this is why it is able to come into this quasi-steady state. And I'll just point out this another important timescale showed by this light blue dot dashed line. This is sort of the thermal relaxation timescale. So the time it takes for the star's structure to respond to the changes in its mass. And in all cases, this sort of response time is short compared to the others. But theoretically, if we were able to feed the stars fast enough, they might not have time for, say, fusion in their cores to respond. And in that case, the star might actually just run away. And so people have thought about that, and maybe you would end up with something like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 mass stars, sort of limited instead by just how much gas the disk has. But unfortunately, we can't simulate that because that is precisely when our code breaks. But this is sort of physically what is going on to lead to the sort of intermediate stars versus regular stars versus immortal stars. Now, this just illustrates what happens when we take one of those immortal stars and cut it off. And the idea here is that AGN don't last forever. So eventually the disk will dissipate. So we had just some accretion rate governing the evolution of this star. And then at this point, or roughly the time marked by the arrow, the accretion rate was set to zero. And the star just went on about its life. So in these cases, the star eventually drives these very, very strong winds and will, in the end, it reaches about 12 solar masses. So it should eventually go through some supernova that might be able to be observed and should enrich the environment with heavy elements. Then another thing to check is the extent to which the different assumptions we made along the way matter. One possible worry we had was, okay, so these immortal stars are really, that's kind of crazy. I've never even thought of a star like that. What if it is because of our assumptions about mass loss? So what if actually as these stars reach this Eddington limit where they're tearing themselves apart with radiation forces, what if the accretion rate actually goes to zero? Is it just because we're allowing the mass loss and accretion that we're getting this quasi-steady state? So actually our default assumptions are showed at this top panel, where just looking at the mass of the star versus time for different gas densities. And then this bottom panel is so the same densities and such, but instead just completely cutting off accretion when stars reach this Eddington luminosity. And as we might expect, it is harder to make immortal stars under these assumptions. But still, if we increase the density enough, immortal stars can still exist. So the quantitative result changes of exactly where immortal stars exist in these disks, but that they exist doesn't seem to depend too much on this assumption. Then another thing we looked at is, so earlier I had painted this picture of sort of the length scale at which gas becomes bound to the star being set by the escape speed from the star and the gas sound speed. And that's all well and good when that is a small distance, it isn't very far from the star, that gas is definitely bound to the star. But that ignores the fact that these stars are in an accretion disk around a supermassive black hole. So there's another length scale that matters, and that is, it's called the Hill radius. And that is really just quantifying how far away you go from the star and gas is still bound to the star instead of being bound to the supermassive black hole. So if we also add this condition that this gas actually needs to be bound to the star instead of the supermassive black hole, then we get this middle panel. So again, it is a little more difficult to produce immortal stars, but if the gas is dense enough, and these are all still pretty reasonable, if not low densities for gas in AGN, it's still possible to produce these immortal stars. Although actually we've seen a larger range of intermediate stars, which would be sort of more optimistic for these leading to supernovae and other transients. Is another thing we've looked into more recently is what happens if the composition of the disk is different. In particular, there's that argument I mentioned earlier that a large population of these stars might really enhance the helium content in these disks. But also, we had just been picking a roughly solar value earlier, and just people have measured the essentially the helium mass fraction in the narrow line emission regions of these AGN and found that could be the gas could be almost half helium. So these sort of things have motivated us to just look into what happens when the stars accrete helium-rich gas. And we found, well, so physically the important thing is that as the stars accrete sort of more helium-rich material, the stars end up being more luminous. And this is just because the stars have a higher mean molecular weight, or their gas does. And this leads to the stars having sort of lower maximum masses on average and higher densities being required for these immortal stars to exist. And that is just illustrated by these curves shown here, which is plotting just the critical density for the intermediate to immortal star transition. Then along the way, we tested this for two different assumptions about the opacity of the gas, just because if you have more opaque gas, then the feedback from radiation on that gas is stronger. Whereas, of course, if the gas is more transparent, you need more radiation to exert an appreciable force on it. I guess one other thing that we looked into is what happens if we take into account the rotation of these stars. So as this gas is falling onto the stars, it has some non-zero angular momentum probably. So as these stars accrete, they probably spin up to be pretty rapid. And in this case, it's actually a lot harder to have immortal stars, because even if you have these sort of quasi-steady mass stars, they lose mass as winds that has about the average stellar angular momentum, but then the gas they accrete can have even more angular momentum than that. So eventually they start spinning really, really fast. And when you have fast spinning star, people think that that makes it easier. So you have that sort of centrifugal support, and that can help make it easier to unbind stellar material as winds. So that makes it a lot harder to actually have immortal stars. Although in cases where the stars don't accrete very much angular momentum, you still get these. But rapid rotating stars are also exciting because at the end of lives, they're expected to produce things like gamma ray bursts, which might be easier to observe. Just to look at a couple examples of this, so some other groups have gone and modeled what happens if we just set off explosions in these accretion disks. So these top panels are showing synthetic light curves from simulations of explosions in these disks. The case on the left is looking at sort of a higher density disk. And the main factor in both of these really is that the disk is really, really dense and really optically thick. So it takes a long time for the photons to diffuse out of the disk. And in this case, although the flare is pretty bright, it lasts a few hundred days, sort of depending on the band you're looking in. Then on the right, in a lower density disk, the transient ends up more than a magnitude brighter in some cases. But it also doesn't last quite as long because the photons are diffusing outwards more quickly. Then the bottom panel here is just showing some calculations of GRB afterglow models. But instead of just sort of the actual sort of prompt afterglow, which is shown with these dotted lines, so in both radio and optical here, because it takes the photons so long to diffuse through the disk, so this was a denser disk case, you end up having a GRB afterglow sort of happen at much later times and get delayed by just photon diffusion. But this is sort of an active field that people are just have been putting a lot of effort into to try and actually explain some of those flares I showed earlier. And one other thing, actually, so I think it's neat that the prediction here came back in 2021, but people have cooked up ways to try and produce neutrinos from explosions in these disks. And the idea here is that if you have one of these GRBs going off and it has a jet, because of the dense EGN disk around, that jet could get choked and you could have a bunch of shocks. And these shocks could play a role in accelerating particles that lead to neutrino production. And these people predicted that you could get up to 2 ice cube detectable neutrinos per GRB in these disks for at least a close EGN. And so this was back in 2021. And then, I mean, not too long ago, Ice Cube announced, a statistical overabundance of relatively highly probable neutrino triggers in a local AGN. So it seems like there's strong evidence in the Ice Cube data that there are a lot of high energy neutrinos coming from a local-ish AGN. So that's kind of exciting. And here's just a cartoon for that mechanism. But then also, if you end up having, say, a magnetar form from the collapse of one of these stars, we know from at least our galaxy that these magnetars often have flares. So if you have a flaring magnetar inside a sort of dense magnetized AGN disk, that might end up giving you the conditions you need to produce fast radio bursts and even repeating ones. So that's something else that people are thinking about. And then with that, I'd be happy to take any more questions or, you know, chat about eclipse events, that too. So thank you very much.
Well, before we ask questions, I would like to thank our speaker for this really incredible talk. Thanks so much, Alex, for this talk. And can we have a show of hands? I know it's hard. You have to turn on your volume again, or else you can just start clapping.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I have a question. This is Susan Schiffman. You talked about metals, that there were some metals in these active galactic nuclei. What have you seen them? What compounds? What elements or compounds?
Was that this sort of thing? Or I guess I talked about it in general.
In general. I'm interested in the metals. And are there metals in the center of a black hole that could be spewing out with all these gases that you're talking about?
Yeah, I could have been more precise. So generally, so when I say something like metallicity, that's really just the total content of the gas that is elements heavier than helium.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be carbon or actual, I'd say, legitimate metals like iron. So it really depends. For something like the measurements shown here, if I remember correctly, the magnesium lines are usually pretty visible in these spectra, for example. Another less traditional metal, some AGN have pretty prominent nitrogen lines and also carbon lines. So it really depends, but we see evidence for a few different lines. There's usually sort of it depends on the wavelength, but in sort of rest frame ultraviolet, there's something of an iron continuum or a continuum composed of many iron lines sort of blended together. But then in X-ray, for example, we see very distinct iron lines, as well as I think others like calcium.
But I'm thinking about the whole periodic table. Here we are on Earth with all these elements, okay? And somehow I don't see them in space. that's my problem.
Okay, yeah. So if the supernovae are going off in these disks, that would produce some heavier ones, right? So a lot of nickel, cobalt, and whatnot. But then the heavier ones, I think, are mostly thought to be, well, that's still somewhat debated, I think. But many of the heavier ones, like gold, platinum, lead, are probably more from merging neutron stars, for example. And it's a challenge to make some materials that are, that you need a really neutron-rich environment to make some of the heavier elements. And I guess neutron star mergers could happen in these disks, but that's an even more complicated problem.
Okay.
But actually, people have looked on it, at it. I didn't include it here, but there have been at least a few papers looking at really heavy metal production from neutron star mergers in these disks.
I wanted to just clarify one thing. When you were talking about those explosions in the disks, I guess just a you were saying two, their prediction was that there would be two neutrinos that would be detected by ice group, not 2 million, but two.
Two, yes.
Just two.
Per GRB.
Per GRB, okay.
Yeah. And then that's up, the two, I think, was their more optimistic prediction. But
of course, there's zillions of them, but they can only find two.
Yes, so this is, it would make many more neutrinos, but the idea was that it might have, say, two neutrino triggers in Ice Cube from one of these.
Ah, okay. Ice Cube.
Mm. Yeah, I should have been more precise about that.
You're quite clear. I just good wanted question. To, you know. Wow. Yeah. I remember working on Compton Gamma Ray Space Telescope team. I was just a teacher intern making some models of devices to detect some of this stuff with cubes. And it's amazing how much has been learned. This is almost 30 years. And 30 years is a long time in astronomy. And they're just trying to figure out what the heck are these things. Okay, are there any more questions?
I have a question, if I may. This is David Martin. I've got my my pen name up there, but I'm actually in Arabic and Persian literature. But anyway, I heard yesterday about them. Jana Levin and another astrophysicists were talking about supermassive black holes as vacuum condensates with pools of dark energy within them as a mechanism to explain the early massiveness of black holes in the universe and these galaxies that have been found 500 million to 700 million years after the Big Bang. Do you have any comments on this explanation?
Not really. I frankly, I'm not familiar with that specific work on this.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so unfortunately, that's a little beyond my realm of expertise. But yeah, there are it's a fun problem to think about. Just because they're such amazing objects, it really challenges a lot of our understanding.
Thank you much.
There do definitely continue to be lots of gaps with dark matter. We alone, even if you don't believe in dark energy, that's the vast majority of the matter in the universe that we have no clue as to what it is. So and it's pretty hard to model. So have you taken into account any of the dark matter gravitational effects?
Yeah, so sometimes yes, actually. So the main effect of dark matter on these scales, most of the time, dark matter doesn't play much of a role, just because the supermassive black holes, gravity dominates everything. So just when you're close enough to the supermassive black hole, dark matter really doesn't do very much. The only place that dark matter has really come into play is when if you're trying to model these accretion disks on really, really large scales. So going from, maybe tens plus parsecs. If you try to model, say, that big an accretion disk, then, say, the dark matter halo starts to play a more appreciable role in, say, the disk's rotation profile, things like that. So a little bit of dark matter comes into play there, but that's about it.
Okay. And thoughts about modified Newtonian dynamics don't come in much either as an alternative explanation.
So actually the way that I took, so when I was doing that, we just sort of parameterized it in terms of whatever the velocity dispersion was of stars, was how we modeled it. So we took a, you could rearrange the velocity dispersion and sort of get an effective potential.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Dittman? Okay, well, thank you very much for this talk. I'm still digesting it. And let's again give him a round of applause if we can. Thank you very much for coming.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Looking well, it will be nice to have these at the observatory again or in person, I think.
I agree.
So we were talking at a little committee meeting the other day, and I told Melissa, I was like, I'm a little bit nervous about NCA starting to meet back up because it'll be the first program in 3.5 years. And we normally have, you know, pre-pandemic, we averaged about 45 people at the NCA meetings. I would not be surprised if we have close to 500 people show up. Because there will be a lot of people who are eager to get back to the observatory. I am very nervous about the first couple of meetings. Because, yeah, so it'll be interesting.
In other words, show up early.
You might also tell people they can park across the way at the University of Maryland system thing.
I know what to do. Been doing it 22 years.
Right. I parked over there before.
Right.
Do you need any assistance getting anything ready?
We will be talking about that later. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So apparently the Perspectives had a great time last night.
It seems like it.
I got a text from Giannina at 1:15, roughly.
Did she send the pictures?
Not yet, no.
Okay, so we did take a group photo at the observatory last night.
Nice.
Oh.
Good. Very good. Yes, the prospective graduate students were visiting Thursday, Friday, and I think they finished up today. And so they had a little get together at the observatory. It cleared up for a brief little bit. We actually had the two telescopes set up and we looked at Orion, the Orion Nebula, or the Sword of Orion, and Mars with one of the telescopes. And then I left right afterwards because, you know, I'm an old fart and wasn't, you know, going to fit in with all those youngsters. And I watched the all sky camera video this morning and it got cloudy like 10 minutes after I left. So I think we had a nice sucker hole and it was good that we took advantage of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a group of them had a lot of fun looking at just stargazing outside, even without the telescopes.
Yep. And as a reminder, we do have the clocks changing tonight. Spring forward.
Yep.
That's tonight.
Yeah, tomorrow, you can brag, tomorrow, the shortest day of the year.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, 23
only
hours.
23 hours long.
Yeah.
Shortest weekend of the year.
That's true.
As Bob McCracken then used to call it, night dark wasting time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does make it harder to get out. Yeah, thanks for those suggestions about Printify, I think it was, an on-demand t-shirt printing.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. We can probably put together a little team to go into detail and figure out, because there will have to be some coordination between setting up sort of the shop and linking it to like our, you know, our account so that the money goes to the right place and stuff like that. So we'll need some coordination. We'll have to have a little team put together to work on it.
Yeah, you know, we could, we have enough money. We could let everybody buy one of a list of items, you know, for free. I don't know how we do with that.
Nah, I mean,
Maybe just when people renew.
Anyway,
how about talking to the treasurer first?
Right.
Yeah.
I have something here to show everyone if my camera will work long enough for you to see.
Your camera's, is your camera on? There we go.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there it is. Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's the historical one.
Yeah, I got a few like that.
Was scanned, yeah. Elizabeth, I don't know if anybody else was watching the captions, but they're pretty good.
Yeah, they're generally pretty good, although it's quite entertaining when they're not.
Yeah, but you can, if it messes up on the scientific terms, you can usually figure out what it was.
Right.
But it's a lot better than some of the captioning I've seen.
Right.
Is that something that is part of Zoom, or do you have to add that?
No, it is part of Zoom. And I usually manage to turn it on for a lot of my other meetings. And so if I haven't had it on before for NCA, sorry. but I mean, anyone can actually turn it on, I think, if they want to be able to follow along. We usually turn it on for some of our international meetings.
Good idea.
And just because it makes it a little bit, it actually does help a little bit with understanding sometimes.
Oh yeah. So, I always keep the subtitles on when I'm watching a movie, no matter what language it's in.
Yeah. So, do we know, so John, do you have who's going to be next month's speaker? Do you want to give a preview or anything?
I'd have to look at my list.
It's in Stardust.
I don't have it on the, I don't have it on the top of my head.
Yeah, I think it's in Stardust. Where'd it go?
Joe Pesci. The Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. Game Changing Science.
Yeah.
Everything you need is in Stardust. Thank you, Todd, for once again another wonderful issue.
Thank you. You wrote most of it.
I did write a lot of it. I tend to be way too prolix.
Okay. Any other questions or things to show, or?
Oh, that's good. I'm way, comma, two, comma, per licks.
I'm very glad we have some students here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
I'm looking at the.
Hi, William. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. This was really fun.
Good.
What school are you from?
Well, right now I'm an eighth grader at a school called Newport Mill in Kensington. But next year I'm going to be a student in the Montgomery Blair STEM Magnet Program.
Very nice.
Cool. Good job.
Thank you for this. This was really fun.
Good.
Good.
Okay. Well, good night, everybody.
Yeah. Right. Goodbye.
Good night. We'll see y'all next month. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.